Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Four Terms and a Podcast. We're lucky to be joined today by former Celtic and Manchester United player Brian McClair. Brian, thanks very much for coming on the show.
You won't be saying that at the end of the show.
Hopefully. So what we'll do, obviously you've just released your own podcast, which we'll discuss later in the call. But firstly, we'll just go back to obviously getting into football for yourself and then your career, which was a very good one. So just growing up, what was your thoughts on football at the time? Who were your kind of heroes at that time?
Well, I fell in love with football after watching or after seeing highlights of the 67 European Cup victory in Lisbon when I was at primary school, when I would be about 5 years of age. And I vividly remember thinking, that's what I want to do. I became smitten with football. And that time when I was at primary school, we used to play, play times, we used to be two play times, one in the morning, one after lunchtime, and we all split into a tennis ball. I don't know, we weren't allowed to have a big ball in case we smashed any windows. I don't know if that was a reference into how poor our control was of the ball. And I've made my first appearance as I think I was 9 for the school team, which turned out to be a very miserable experience. I still wonder to this day why I persevered with football, because it was hailstone that day, very, very cold. I played left back. I was drookit. I think I might have been verging on having hypothermia. We lost the game at least 5-0. I was playing left back, and every time the ball came to me, because I'd never played structured football like that before, I just kicked the ball forward. I didn't make any attempts to pass or interact really in the game. And as I say, I was frozen at the end. Thoroughly miserable experience. No idea why I continued to do it. To want to play, but I was there again playing the next week. I just loved it. I still love it. I mean, it's been an interesting situation this week with different things. I became a fan of Celtic and a fan of football, and I became a football player. And then going through that, being a fan of football, come out of my playing and my coaching career, and I'm a fan. You know, and I think that's been highlighted this week, how important that is.
Yeah, it's obviously been a very busy week regarding the Super League, which has just dominated the headlines down south and obviously worldwide. That obviously wasn't the best debut, that you were ready to chuck it at 9 years old.
I wasn't ready to chuck it. I'm just saying I don't know why I didn't. I didn't chuck it, as I'm saying, but I don't understand, you know, when I reminisce about it, there wasn't anything, apart from the thrill of it being my first ever game for my primary school team, there wasn't anything else about that day that I could say was a positive experience.
But as you say, as you stuck with it, and then your first club was Motherwell, is that correct?
No, I went to Aston Villa when I was 16.
How was that going down south, obviously, at 16?
I'd been there a number of times, and one of the attractions of going there was that there was two parts to it. The youth development officer, Dave Richardson, was very keen for me to sign, and I was always interested in continuing my education, and they were willing to try and sort something out where they could, because even though you're working, been involved full-time football, and I've been an apprentice, we had the football training, and we had football training in the afternoon, we also had jobs to do, we still had enough spare time that I would have been able to study, you know, in the evenings. So we planned out an idea, planned out an offer of football and education, which was going to involve me doing an A-level maths course. But Dave Richardson left in the summer that I signed. And there was the new youth development officer who came in, Brian Jones, didn't know anything about it. And he did his best to try and facilitate that, but it just wasn't possible to do the A-level. So I spent a year learning about football, adult life, and doing the jobs that were required at that particular time. Aston Villa won the league that year, so I like to think I had a big part to play in that. I cleaned Dennis Mortimer, who was the captain's boots. I believe that that he had easily the shiniest boots in the old First Division then. So that was my claim to first kind of success in professional football.
So there you go. You basically won Aston Villa the league at 16.
I didn't say I won them, but I think I contributed to it. Yeah, I think it's been overlooked, that contribution that I made.
There you go. I wanted to start for Motherwell and obviously miss out. But
yeah, well, what was really good about Aston Villa was that I was, as I said, being attracted to go there by the experiences I'd had when I'd went on trial, and the fact that they wanted me. Whatever, you soon learn an interest and a tough lesson. Football as a 16-year-old, that although Dave Richardson wanted me, it was quite clear that the youth team coach didn't fancy me. And so early on, I got a very pertinent lesson in that football was about opinions. The only opinion that counts is the coach who picks the team. And that coach at that particular time didn't really see me as first choice. It's a lesson that I took on board. Worked hard, continued to work hard every day, and at the end of when I went back in the pre-season, for some reason they found out that I had been offered places at university. Not that was ever going to be my first choice, because I wanted to continue to play as a football. And I got called into the manager's office, Ron Saunders, who was the manager of the title-winning team, and he told me I was free to go and just to go and pack my bags, which was another tough experience that I had right at the very beginning of my journey as a professional football player. I came back up the road and then again the ego from being quite low, having been released as a football player at 17 then, to wonder what you're going to do, and still having a burning desire to be a professional football player. And I went on trial to Motherwell, who were managed by Ali McLeod at the time. So I went from there, and after one day there, I was asked to go and see Ali McLeod in his office, and he not only wanted to sign me, which was a great fill-up to the disappointment I'd had the week before, but he also wanted me to play in the first team. So I was going from one situation where I hardly had got a game at Aston Villa, the youth team, to the manager of a Scottish First Division team wanting to play me in his first team. So I really had a bit of an incredible time over a very short period. I didn't...
No, I was just going to say, as you say, is it all that matters is who's picking the team? One coach might be in at the time.
Yeah, so I
hello, can you hear me? I think the lines went dead. Hello? Hello.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. I don't know what happened there. We'll just edit that bit out. That's fine. I don't know if you've went again. I don't know what's happening. Can you hear me? Hello?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. It just seems to... It was dropping out there. I don't know what's happened.
I'll put you on loudspeaker. Ali McLeod, and then I played a few games for Motherwell, and then you discovered another harsh part of football in that Alan McLeod lost his job, and Davey Hay actually, he took over as the manager here, being Ali's assistant, and I found myself back out of the team again. And Motherwell went on a 20-game unbeaten run. I didn't really feature very much that season either. So I was definitely on a roller coaster, which never changed really, you know. Peaks and troughs.
You were just saying something there, and then it broke up another wee bit. I don't know if it's maybe just the signal. So, obviously, you went to Villa. That didn't really go to plan. Then Motherwell. And then you came to Celtic, which is obviously what this podcast is all about. How did that come about?
I did a really good year in the 82-83 with Motherwell. Well, not really much good year. I'd actually good half a season because I got into the team with what happened really was Motherwell was had been promoted into the Premier League and was struggling to score goals. And Jock Wallace had decided, him and Frank Connor thought that I could play as a forward. No, I never played as a forward. So I never ever played as a forward in my school football, and I went to Aston Villa as a midfield player. But never in any game had I ever played as a forward. I'd always loved scoring goals, but I was never a forward, really. And they thought that I had an eye for a goal and decided they would play me as a forward. And I had a really good second half of the season, which included an amazing January where I scored a hat-trick against Rangers, and I scored two against Celtic, and I scored a winning goal in an away game at Morton. So I had a pretty decent month, and then ended up scoring enough goals for Motherwell to retain or get enough points. But we managed to get enough points to retain our position in the Premier League. That summer, I went to Mexico to be part of the Scotland's under-19s. Attempt to Scotland's under-19s were participating in the World Cup in Mexico, in the 19 World Cup. So I went there, and when I came home after then we'd been knocked out in the quarterfinals, it was actually Jock Wallace had phoned the house and spoke to my brother, and he wouldn't believe that my brother was telling him he wasn't me, because I think we sound alike. Jock Wallace could get very irate because he thought I was taking the piss, whereas it was my brother who was talking to him. He was telling him that he sold me and he had to get over to third part right away because he wanted to tell me what was going on, you know. And then when I arrived back, my brother seemed great delight in telling me that you've got to go to Motherwell, you've Jock Wallace has sold you, you know. And I was like, what? You know, what do you mean? I said, you've just got to go. And I went over, and he said, oh, I've sold you to Celtic. You've got to go and see. Big Billy's waiting for you at Parkhead, Celtic Park. And I jumped back into my car and drove from Motherwell to Celtic Park, where Billy McNeil was waiting to make me an offer.
I think that must have been a surreal experience. Obviously, you talk about the Lisbon Lions growing up, and then you're there getting signed by the guy who is synonymous with Celtic lifting the European Cup with Billy McNeil.
Aye, and as I said, it was again being part of me on this topsy-turvy ride of professional football player. I was still part-time. I was still a student at Moscow University, and I walked into to Billy McNeil's office, and he offered me a 4-year full-time contract, and I was quite impressed and flabbergasted by this, that I thought, well, this is a chance of playing and having a right good go at being a full-time professional player, and that I thought that, which is proven to be the case, that my physical capabilities would diminish a lot quicker than my mental capabilities, and that I thought, oh, I've got 4 years to try and do something in full time in football, and I could always go back to university. That was my plan, that was 4 years ago, and I've not quite managed to get back to uni yet.
You still get time.
I've not discounted that.
So obviously you go to Celtic. You're playing under Billy McNeil, some tremendous players at Celtic.
No, I didn't play under Billy McNeil. He left. This is the other part of my amazing kind of thing. So once again, I'm signed by somebody who wants you. Billy McNeil claimed and wanted me, and he left to go to Man City. Was it Aston Villa?
I'm not sure. Was that David Hay then coming? Is that right?
And David Hay then got the job, yeah, David Hay. And David Hay came in and got the job. So the 4 years I was at Celtic, David Hay was a manager, and with Frank Connor, who had been Jock Wallace's assistant at Motherwell. So yeah, so the 4 years I was there with David Hay and Frank Connor.
That's quite strange. You're signed by Billy McNeil, but don't actually play under him, and then another
man. Yeah, and then when Billy came back, I left.
It's funny how football works. So obviously, I was just about to touch on some of the players you would have played with, like Danny McGrain, Tommy Burns, McStay, just so many great players. But what was it like to play with these guys?
Well, I mean, for me, it was a pleasure and a joy right away. They made me feel so welcome the minute I walked in the door, and it was just every day being in every day was just about playing football. It was hard work. I mean, pre-season, that's never changed. A lot of running in Strathclyde Park. What I remember about the Strathclyde Park running was we did some hill running, and Bobby Lennox was the reserve team coach in that day, the time when I was there, and he was the fastest out of anybody must have been in his early 40s then, I thought, Bobby, but he was still the fastest, you know, up and down these hills. But all of it was about playing football and enjoying yourself, and by being with them every day, I think that was the big thing for me is I'd been training for 2 years on a part-time basis on a Tuesday and a Thursday, and there was me and one other player. So you were not really going to get a lot of football work with two people, you know. It was mainly a lot more fitness stuff. So when I'm going in there every day and we're playing a lot of football, I'm playing a lot of football with these really good players and characters too. So I remember laughing a lot, having a lot of fun, and playing and doing something that I loved.
Yeah, and one of the, obviously, probably the most famous achievement of that team would have been Love Street in 1986. Unfortunately, before my time, but that's probably up in the top three Celtic games I wish I could have went to. Obviously, getting into that last day, a kind of miracle was needed. I think we needed to win by three clear and hopes Hearts get beaten. I don't think they'd been beaten about 28 games or something like that. What was the feeling getting into that game against St Mirren?
Well, we'd been feeling really good all the way through, because we had to win, I can't remember exactly the number of games, but we got to a point where we had to win every single game from 11 or 12 out, maybe 13 out or something, I can't remember exactly what it was. We had to win every game and hope that at some point along that journey that Hearts would trip up and drop points. And I think that we really believed that we had a great chance when we went to Petardie and beat Aberdeen 1-0. Because we had never, in my time, Aberdeen in the league. Well, I can recall, we went there and things went really well. We beat a very good Aberdeen team 1-0. And after that game, I think we felt that we've got a real good chance of this. Now, we get to the last game of the season, we're away at St Mirren, knowing that we have to win and score at least 3 goals. And you're hoping that then Dundee can upset Hearts at Dens Park. And we played, I mean, there's loads of stuff being made about St Mirren and all that kind of thing, but we played really, really well. I mean, it's not often you get 11 or certainly 10 outfield players who are playing at 8 or 9 out of 10, and some players on that day, I think, maybe even played at 10. And that was how good we were that day. We would have beaten anyone comfortably that day. And we stormed into our lead at half time. That meant that we just had to see out the game and hope that something happened at Dens Park. And also within that game was one of the great goals that I was involved in. Started off with I think it was Paul McStain and Danny McGrath just outside our own penalty box, and ended up with a goal at the other end. As I say, a goal that I'm very pleased to be involved, I've been part of. You know, not Paul tells me every time that I see it, popping up every now and again, and then. That day, Jim Stewart was in goals for St Mirren, and he actually had the ball in his hand when the crowd erupted round him, and there was a great look of amusement on his face of what's going on here, you know, what's happened, you know. And this was the day and the time of where people had small transistor radios, and the first scare a little bit was there was a kind of disappointment, because when the news came through that kids had scored, the Celtic supporters and thought it was Walter Kidd, the Hearts fullback, had scored, and then it came through that no, it was actually Albert Kidd had got a goal for Dundee. Well, there was a great celebration and from the crowd, and then not long after that, Albert managed to get another one, and then by then we were 5-0 up, so it was just a matter of biding our time to the end of the game. And I think I think we finished before their game, so we had to wait quite a while before it was confirmed again through the wonderful world of radio that we were indeed the champions, you know. So yeah, it was a great, wonderful day to be involved in. Fantastic run of games, and I have a wonderful performance by a good team.
Yeah, it was funny. I've watched the clips of it a thousand times. You're talking about that great goal. Just a shame who scored it. And then there was the one where the St Mirren goalkeeper's, I think it's a cross, comes in, it kind of deflects into his arms, and he's just standing there, and the whole place just erupts. Because it was quite late in the game, well, the two Dundee game. I think it was maybe the 84th minute.
Yeah, it was late on, yeah.
Because I think Kidd scores from a corner, and then he plays a 1-2 for the second, and then puts it in, and that was it. And I think there's a pitch invasion and just all the madness that follows. Was that probably your best day at Celtic?
No, I loved every single day that I was there. So it was brilliant to be there. It was a brilliant time. We played football. That the idea of the whole thing was that, and credit to Davy and Frank Connor. I assume this is been something that's come
through their experience and their history and history of Celtic Football Club. It was all about attacking football, that believe we'll score more goals than the opponents. And that's how we trained every day, and that's how we played. And you say there were some wonderful characters. I mean, you mentioned Tommy Burnsnall was a great player. He was one of the funniest guys I've ever come across, you know. He was always cracking jokes or telling stories or making quips that were rib tickling, you know. So it was like there was never any point you were thinking, oh no, I've got to go to wherever today. It was just brilliant fun.
Yeah, Tommy Burns is somebody that's still spoke about all the time at Celtic. He's obviously been gone for 13 years now, and he obviously played such a big part of the club, and he basically just summed up Celtic for me, I think. He just kind of epitomised what Celtic is. But there was, as you say, there were so many great players there as well, the likes of Paul McStay, probably one of the greatest Celtic captains ever as well.
Paul was a good player, yeah, very good player. And I said, they were all good people as well, you know. I mean, they're just about when I was thinking about the coming on your podcast, and I was laughing to myself because there won't be many players nowadays. So remember, we're full time, but there won't be many situations where one of your teammates has laid a carpet for you.
I don't think that ever happens in professional football now. Who was it done that for you?
Well, Tom McAdam used to be a carpet fitter, and he came and fitted a carpet for me.
I think the players have all got people to do every part of their life for them, if it's me.
I just popped out of my head that. I thought that's just like, I don't think that. Maybe, I don't know if, maybe it's part of the thing you're saying there. Maybe people don't know that. The carpets do get laid because they're usually just in situ when you go into that, to whatever it is, or you maybe have some other kind of floor covering of your choice, you know. But I was laughing to myself thinking, you know, Tom McAdam came and laid my carpet.
I think the game's changed a lot since then, unfortunately. I think
the game hasn't really changed. Some of the things might have really changed, but the game hasn't changed. Still, you know, still
the
same amount of players, similar rules, same ball.
The tackles have changed, I suppose.
Well, yeah, the rules have changed. I mean, it's great that it's more in favour of forward attacking football, which is and you want to have that. Although sometimes you think it's maybe been a bit too dumbed down. I'm not maybe at all in favour of any kind of injury threats and stuff, because I mean, there are some mistimes, and people still are. I mean, watching football sometimes are some mistimes, but with the TV cameras and all the other helps or aids for the officials that can deal with that, you know. I mean, it was like in all the games in my career, it was like a free hit, you know, the first 5-10 minutes. And who were pretty, I'll say they were good at it, because that was part of their makeup. Was when you went to Aberdeen, I think particularly with Willie Miller, you know, that you would not be right up in there in the beginning. And in England, Tony Adams was exactly the same. The referee would give a free kick against them, but there was never even a hint of a yellow card for that. So they were saying, like, well, we're here, you know. So they might even get away with it, depending on where you were. I mean, Willie got away with a few more retorted than he might have done it in Celtic Park. But the game's not really changed that much, you know.
I guess the Celtic fans haven't changed much. They're still as fanatical.
No, of course not. That's insane. care about the football club, love the football club, love the football, love it, want to be played in a particular way. And the reputation throughout the world is deserved, because it's the Celtic fan as a collective of worked hard to maintain that reputation of being a people who can feel passionate about the football club, home and away, and certainly throughout Europe. There's I've been to plenty of places where people are, oh, you from Scotland, yeah, well, we had Celtic here a few years ago. The supporters were incredible. You know, all positive ways.
Yeah, the Celtic support, as I say, we've not changed too much, I hope. Maybe this season we've been a wee bit more irate than normal for good reason.
See, the thing about being a football fan, you're entitled to express your opinion, no matter what it is. And a part of one of the major reasons for doing that is because they care. You know, if you don't care about anything anymore, you don't bother having a view on it. You don't bother saying anything about it. You don't bother trying to do anything about it. And that should be a boost to anyone who's, particularly the players, you know, because. You know, I can't say it definitively for every single player, but I'd like to think that most supporters would swap, even for a brief moment, going on and playing in the hoops, even playing badly, right? And playing badly and losing heavily. At least having that being able to sit there and say, well, I played for the hoops, and you know, I actually pulled that. It was that famous strip over my head. I might have been shit, but I played. So players should be pleased that they're actually voicing a view on it. And it's to say that it's a great strength of, and I think it's been badly missed, very badly missed. I'm not saying that Celtic would have went on this year to achieve 10 in a row. But I think that it could have been a lot better. I do think that football clubs like Celtic have missed the fan, the support in the stadium, and hopefully that'll change quite quickly. And once again, the people will be able to go to watch football live. I think football suffered because of that. It's better than nothing. This has been better than no football, but it's a long way short of being as good as it has been when there's been supporters there.
That's it, as Jopsin said, football without fans is nothing, and it has. It's been a very strange year watching an empty Celtic Park.
Yeah.
Old Trafford. Yeah. It's or the Bernabeu or the Camp Nou. It's a strange seeing these stadiums with so much going on, but there's no fans there to witness it. Hopefully for the start of the next season, the fans will be back. That's the hope, but I don't know if it'll be in full. I would highly doubt that.
Yeah, I think there's going to be we don't know. We'll have to wait and see, won't we?
Yeah, just to get back, we kind of get sidetracked there. You left Celtic in, I think it was 1987, to then go to Manchester United.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And then obviously we'll touch on Sir Alex Ferguson.
It was just that my contract was coming to an end. And
hello?
Hi.
Sorry, cut out a wee bit there. Yeah, you were saying your contract came to an end.
Yeah, it was a contract came to an end. David Hayes told me that I was free to speak to any clubs that I wanted to, that would be interested. So, you know, I got approached by a number of clubs. And Manchester United were one of them. And they had been, there was, when it came down to it, there was always going to be a choice between Manchester United or remaining at Celtic. I decided that I ended up deciding to go to Manchester United.
Obviously, Manchester United at that time, Sir Alex, wasn't it long into the job, a job that he ended up in for a long, long time. What was it like to work under him? Obviously, the best manager ever in a lot of people's opinions.
Well, I think, again, going back to the situation or scenario is that when somebody wants you and they've made a big effort to get you to go, then it's going to make a difference. But what I've always felt with them, what I felt and what I learned quite quickly being a player under Alex Ferguson was he was hard, but he was fair, and he was very loyal. And I think I learned lots and lots of things about football, how to play football, tactical in football, and I learned an awful lot about myself and what I was capable of doing mentally and physically. And his demands were very, very high, and it was good to be involved in that as somebody that wanted to be the best at everything. I mean, it, no matter what he was doing, so when he was playing cards or playing golf, or he wanted to be the best of it, and he would strive to be the best he possibly could at that, you know. So yes, I didn't think that even although he was talking about rebuilding a football club, he would be able to rebuild it to such a level and to win so many trophies as they did.
Yeah, you were obviously a big part of the early successes at Manchester United under Sir Alex. What was it like winning your first ever Premier League trophy, or the first ever Premier League trophy, I should say, as well?
It's been a long time since Manchester United had been the champions of England. We were runners up the year before, and which turned out to be the last of the old first division, and we had. It was, again, one of the things is a huge part of why I wanted to play football. You know, I loved playing football, but I also wanted to win. And I had, everywhere I had been, I had won something. You know, or the club had won something. I'm even going back to Aston Villa winning the league. I think particularly the you've had such a long period of time not winning. You get kind of close the year before. You've got football pundits, ex-players saying, oh, that's the best chance that Manchester will ever get. They won't be able to lift themselves up now. They're finished, they're done. To going on to prove all those people in the first instance wrong, and winning the first Premier League, it was a privilege to be involved in that.
You also won the European Cup Winners' Cup in 1991, beating Barcelona 2-1 in the final. I think it was Hughes scored the two goals that day. What was that like to play a European Cup final against Barcelona? That must have been quite an experience as well.
Well, I mean, I'd loved loved it. It was honoured to be part of some great European nights at Celtic Park. And this was the first season that the English clubs had been allowed back into Europe after their exile. So it'd been a really interesting route to the final, and getting to the final against Barcelona in Rotterdam was notable, as I say, for the first time that European clubs have been English clubs are allowed back in. But the same kind of thing we were talking about with regards to fans, I think the fans made the difference for Manchester United that night, walking out into the stadium at Rotterdam. It was kind of typical British weather, where there was a smurf, it was a rain, it was a bit dank. And everywhere around the ground seemed to be have Manchester United fans in it, and it gave us a great feeling to be thinking, well, we may well be underdogs going into this game against these wonderful players that are wearing the Barcelona. So we felt quite confident, we were well prepared. And the tactics that Alex Ferguson started his team talk on that day when he said he pointed his finger to me and said, if you do your fucking job tonight, we'll win the game. And I just looked and thought, oh, well, right, no pressure then. Thanks for that, you know. And my job was to make sure that any time that Ronald Koeman had the ball, was that I had to be right next to him, because he was a playmaker, and that was my job. And the main focus of my job, Ronald Koeman did score the goal in the last minute, but it was from a free kick. I've had so many incredible experiences and memories in football, and that was another one to cherish.
Yeah, absolutely. I read a stat there. I don't know whether, but half of these stats are probably no two on Wikipedia, but it says that you scored in every round apart from the final. Is that correct?
I have no idea about details of things. I remember bits and pieces about, as you say, things like that, Rotterdam and Love Street and things like that. But when it comes to the statistical analysis of my playing career, I'm in the dark, yeah.
So am I, unfortunately. This podcast isn't professional enough to pull up on the stats. just obviously playing at Manchester United, there was obviously that era of players that came through, like Giggs, Scholes, Neville, Beckham. What was it like watching those guys kind of develop, and obviously the careers they went on to have?
Younger players invigorate you, and you need competition, and they provided competition right throughout the squad. And there were good guys who have all gone on to achieve wonderful, incredible things at Manchester United and elsewhere. They were the future, you know. You could see that when they were slowly allowed to be part of the first team group, they had been given an opportunity, they were given a chance, and that's the thing that you need as a football player. As I mentioned before, my kind of roller coaster ride in football is that you need to be given a chance. I think if you ask any football player, they'll probably remember the first game and how did it come about. And usually it came about because the manager decided that he was going to play you. And a lot of the times it was because somebody might have been injured or suspended, or the manager had fallen out of favour with, or maybe somebody had retired, and they just felt that, and they gave this young player the chance. I think that the most relevant scenario for that this season has been Barcelona. Barcelona found themselves in financial difficulties with regards to times of the past, and they've played a lot of players young players who have come through their academy. And what happens a lot of times when you play young players with some good experienced players is two things. One, that the young players can surprise you. I think that's been the case. Everybody's been saying, oh, Barcelona won't be competitive this year. It's a rebuilding, this and that. Well, it's proven that, like that Manchester United group, you can be competitive because a lot of them turn out to be good enough. They just need an opportunity and enough games to play and enough games to become regulars. And also, they can reinvigorate other players around you. Now, from what I can gather, although Messi's had a slow start, he is playing some of the best football that he's ever played. And so is Busquets, who's another one that seems to have been re-energised by these young players around about them. And that's what happens. And not enough teams now. Maybe they will have to, because of the of financial aspects. But there's not enough of letting the young player play. They need to get opportunities. A lot of managers are too scared. They forget how they ever got a chance to play. Far too much emphasis on the experienced players. Let young players play, and they will surprise you.
I think that ties in perfectly for what I was going to touch on next. Obviously, you finished your career in Motherwell after Man United. It was a short stint, and then you retired. Was that 1998?
Yeah.
And then you obviously had a period of time, or a long period of time, at Man United as the director of youth. And obviously, you were going on there, the emphasis on giving youth a chance, which is something that Celtic have excelled in to a degree. And then in other aspects, they failed miserably. Notably, one of the big bonuses of giving youth a chance was Kieran Tierney. But then this season, we've lost quite a lot of kind of up-and-coming talents, and it's been kind of trying to find out why. And I think it's the lack of first-team football and chances.
Well, I'd say that's well, that's what you need to have. You need to be brave. You need to have a policy as well. Well, see, that's up to the club sometimes to dictate what they expect of. You know, if you've got a good youth policy, you want to be able to challenge your manager or your coach. To play players, you know. So if you've got an idea that you want to utilise these players, you've got to have someone who's going to let them have a go. And I've said that you can dictate that. You can say that you'll give you the job, but then you're allowed to recruit a certain amount of these players here. You need to be taking them into your first team squad. And you won't know about them until they get in and train and play with them, with your the players that you've your older players or your more established players, and as I say that I think that the clubs should, if they believe in the youth development, should dictate to the manager. And then the question, the manager then's job is to turn around and give you reasons why he believes that, well, first of all, he's got to be saying, they're giving you evidence to say, look, I've given them enough opportunities. I don't think they're quite, we believe in it. But part of that is should be a plan. You have a plan and say, well, what is it? What satisfies it? At the end, the player themselves is going to make themselves a player. I'll be down to what they do. So you're talking about any young players. You're talking about when Kieran Tierney was given an opportunity to come into Celtic's first team and play. And he came in and made a difference. Made it so much so that he became a regular a regular player. Now, other players who might not have quite run, you've got to ask the question of, have they been given enough opportunities? And if they've been given opportunities, what went wrong? Well, was it down to the player who not quite have the mentality for it? They not quite have the athleticism? They not quite have the confidence? But you should be able to, you should be able to give answers to that. It should never be about, and some, as I said at the beginning, about football is about opinions. It's an opinion of the coach who picks the team that matters. But they need to be brave enough, and they need to be able to give the hierarchy of a football club the answers to those questions. Why is that player now flourishing there? He could have been this, or he could have been that. And it really depends on what your expectations are, and what your goals are as a club, and what your goals are season by season.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, as I say, Kieran Tierney was just one of the names I mentioned. We've also had Callum McGregor, who's come on to be a fantastic player. And that's through, I think it was Ronnie Dyla, actually, the old Celtic manager, gave quite a lot of these guys a chance. And it paid off big time for us. We obviously get $25 million for Tierney, which is a great piece of business for Celtic, and that is obviously a big part of our structure, is getting players and then moving them on for more money. Just as well, to touch on, I completely missed out Scotland. You played for Scotland. That must have been a proud experience to play for your country, get into the youth coming up as well.
Aye, well, I had the honour of representing my country at the Euros in Sweden, where we played games. Although it was very much a smaller situation in that there was only 16 teams in the finals. I think it was 16 in the finals, you know, and we had played the Netherlands, Germany, and which was USSR at the time was called CES, I think, you know. So great time, really good. We played well, but we didn't accrue enough points to get us. I think that was absolutely. We didn't get enough points to go through. But, great to be there. Once again, of the very fond memories of the passion and the joy of the Tartan Army in Sweden.
How do you think Scotland will fare in this Euros? They've been out the Euros for 21 years, but they're now back in. Do you think they can challenge with the squad they've got?
I think that right away you can see that what Scotland have managed to do, and it's been a big part of their qualification, is that they don't lose many goals. They've got a very good defensive base. They've got the choice for a couple of very good goalkeepers, and I think that'll be the important part. And then it'll be down to whether the flair players can perform and create enough chances to potentially score goals. But yeah, I think that in the group, that you have to say that England would be overall favourites for that. In competitions like this, is not to say that there will be surprises, and hopefully Scotland can be one of those surprises.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching it. I do enjoy the international tournaments when they're on. Just moving on before we finish, you've now got your own podcast, Life with Brian, the Brian McClair podcast. So just what is the podcast about, and how did it come about, basically?
Well, I've been doing a diary thing for several years, which is a kind of
whimsical kind of look on football. Some serious stuff, some humorous stuff. And a number of people have been asking for a while if they'd ever thought we'd doing a podcast. So we thought that we would try and then see how it would go. So we've done four now, and I wanted it to be a kind of situation where what I wanted it to be was like I have friends of mine listening to it while they were out walking, and it was a distraction from life and everything that's going on, and I've had some decent feedback that for them that's been the case, diverting, humorous, but also informative, and so we would just enjoy doing it. I think that's when you enjoy doing something, I think that comes across in what your output is. So it's something else to do, and hopefully, as I say, people enjoy listening to it. Even one person enjoys listening to it, that makes it worthwhile.
No, absolutely. I mean, I know what you mean. It's enjoyable. I mean, just doing the podcast, we get people listening, and then we get at how much shite we talk and all that stuff. So it's great to get feedback on it as well. So for people listening, where's the best place to find the podcast?
Find it on Twitter, Life with Brian, or where you get any other podcast, Heaven or Hell, whatever that is.
Yeah, so it's on Twitter, at Brian McClure Pod. So when we put this out, we'll get people to give it a follow as well. So yeah, the Brian McClure podcast is available on sort of take it Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
All platforms have got podcasts.
Yeah, that's great. So make sure to subscribe and tune in to Brian's podcast. And yeah, I think that brings us to there.
Don't make sure. Just that's on. People are free to do whatever they want. I mean, I enjoy doing it. It'd be good for people who are interested in it. It's been great being on talking to you and your podcast. And you know, I hope you enjoyed this few minutes chatting. Because that's really what it's just been about, you know. It's about people chatting, enjoying themselves and telling a few stories.
Yeah, no, I've loved it. It's always great to speak to kind of Celtic legends for the past. It's always great to have them on the show and speak about some of the iconic days in the history, like Love Street in 86 and some of the great players that we've had. So it's been an absolute honour to have you on the show.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Cheers.